Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So now Honduras is, in terms of countries that are able to keep good records, the most deadly place per capita on Earth. That's 83 homicides per 100,000 people in the population per year. That's about double the rates currently in Afghanistan or Iraq. And the second most deadly country in the world at that, in measuring it that way, is El Salvador.
That's the voice of journalist from the Real News Network, Jesse Friesen. On this week's show, we speak to Jesse about the ongoing intense repression post-coup in Honduras and the people's resistance and what can we learn from that in the North. So stay tuned.
I'm privileged to be with Jesse Friesen. He is an international journalist. We reach him in Montreal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Talk a little bit about the impact of the continued violence against the people in Honduras post-military coup.
It's important to recognize that, you know, while levels of violence have certainly gone up since the military coup, that this didn't necessarily start with the military coup. That said, there's no doubt that the murder rate has gone up, and particularly in certain sectors, it's gone up considerably. So now Honduras is, in terms of countries that are able to keep good records, the most deadly place per capita on Earth. That's 83 homicides per 100,000 people in the population per year. That's about double the rates currently in Afghanistan or Iraq. And the second most deadly country in the world at that, in measuring it that way, is El Salvador, right next door. There's various reasons for why this is happening, but the main thing that people need to realize is that when this is happening, and you've got a post-coup regime that is dedicating all its resources, legal and security-wise, to political work, that is to say that there's all kinds of police and military resources being dedicated to infiltrating, policing, cracking down, and many people allege assassinating leaders and social movements, that when this is happening, that means that there's very little work done to investigate murders of any kind, which means that in Honduras today, the best way to get rid of somebody that's getting in your way is to kill them. So the easiest way, perhaps, whether they be people organizing in the land occupation movement in Honduras' Aguan Valley, which has seen over 50 leaders assassinated since the military coup in the past 2 years, or below President Lobo, who came to power just after the military coup, so in just 2 years. And the most publicized that we've seen of late has been the journalists. So Honduras has recently been named the most deadly place on Earth for journalists. And there's been a push from the right to say that this is just all happening in line with the rise in violence across the society, and journalists are just kind of getting caught in the crossfire, you know, so to say. But one statistic that almost nobody's talking about, even people on the left, and it's to be understood because people aren't very familiar with the work of these journalists that are dying. Most news organizations, in fact, none, have a Honduras bureau that is actually staying on top of this stuff. But of the 17 journalists that have been killed since Pepe Lobo came to power 2 years ago, 16 of them have published work either against the regime or against the major, you know, 10 to 15 families that supported the coup in the first place. And they make up much less than half, you know, of the journalists in the country that are doing this kind of critical work. The majority of the journalists in Honduras don't do this kind of critical journalism. It is a specific kind of journalist that is being killed in Honduras. It is the journalist that is questioning the powers that be, and particularly those people that have benefited from the military coup in 2009. These are the people that are being killed. So anytime you hear somebody suggest that these journalists are being killed because they're just getting caught, you know, in the broader drug war or drug gangs or a general rise in violence, that's not true. And this statistic is the one that should really blow that out of the water. Not to mention, you know, there's been all kinds of journalists that have survived, you know, critical journalists that have survived to tell stories about how the death threats that they've received. You know, I've seen the text message. I've been with a fellow journalist who received a death threat on a text message while I was sitting beside him. This is daily life in Honduras for the journalists that are doing critical work. And while it is related to the rise in murders, just because there's no investigation of murders, which allows people to do this with impunity, it is not because of it. It's their work that is putting them in harm's way.
Can you talk a little bit about the work that many of these journalists were doing with relation to what is happening to the safety net, like education, social services, food production?
Food production. The Aguan Valley is a place right now where we're seeing an incredible showdown between two models of agricultural production. That's cooperative, campesino-run production versus corporate agribusiness production. In the Aguan Valley, you've got a group of about 13 cooperatives that have been around for 40 years, and they offer their members really what, you know, we would recognize in North America as a middle-class lifestyle. All their kids go to school. They get full scholarships to any university that they get accepted to, provided by the co-op. There's healthcare on site. People live in, you know, sturdy houses that withstood the Hurricane Mitch in 1998, as opposed to the housing of everybody else in the zone that was completely wiped out by that hurricane, you know, as an example. And so right now, there's a whole group of people that have occupied agribusiness plantations, thousands of families, saying, no, we want this co-op model for us as well. And so they've occupied the land, and as a result, they've been slowly being eliminated one by one. But they maintain that land occupied. There's about 10,000 hectares in the Aguan Valley that can currently be considered as occupied out of a total of about 35,000 hectares of arable land. And that's an open conflict. To talk about the work that journalists do, this is a really good example. Journalists have been relatively unwilling to actually go into these occupied areas and actually interview the people involved in the occupations and perhaps get a glimpse of what their lifestyle is like in there and what they're after. The mainstream media in Honduras routinely portrays them as terrorists, as communists, as agents of Chavez, as agents of Castro, as agents of Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, as being funded by the FARC in Colombia. Even the former security minister, Lobo, who recently was fired, well, for a lot of reasons, actually went as far as to suggest that the campesinos in the Aguan Valley were somehow related to Al-Qaeda. And so there's just an across-the-board demonization of these people, and nobody really goes in to do this, to do the kind of work that could actually inform people about why they're there and what they're doing. I just want to quickly tell the story of Naum Palacios. Naum Palacios was a journalist for a local television station in Tocoa, which is the major city in the Aguan Valley. He decided to go in together with his coworker, Mario Munguia. They went in and did a brief kind of 15-minute report for the television station on the occupation, one of the occupations. He immediately received death threats not to publish the report once people realized what they were doing. They published it anyways, and a week later, he was machine-gunned dead in his car. His cameraman and editor, Mario Munguia, fled into exile for 3 months and has since returned to Honduras, but is terrified for his life. Naum Palacios had already been given what they call protective measures by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, because immediately after the coup, even before he had really published anything against the coup, he was identified by the military as somebody who potentially might be against the coup, and was actually held up in solitary confinement for a few days following the coup. His family had no idea where he was, and when he was released, he went to the Inter-American Court for Human Rights and got these protective custodies, which meant that the Honduran state was then to become responsible for his life, was essentially told by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights that you are responsible for this person's protection. We will blame you if he dies. And a week after he puts out this report, actually giving a face to these campesinos that are these farmers, small and landless farmers that have occupied this land, he was found dead. So that's an example of the work that journalists are doing that's finding them dead. And to give you a sense of the impunity, there was no autopsy done on his body until 3 months after he had been buried, when the Committee to Protect Journalists finally put out a report on what was happening in Honduras. and put some pressure on the Honduran regime, that's when they did the autopsy. And you can go on the CPJ website and find a picture of them digging up his body in the cemetery in Tocoa 3 months after it was buried.
We now know that the Canadian government has signed an agreement with the government of Pepe Lobos. And I wonder if you could talk about the threat that this poses to the campesinos of the Awant area.
In general, you know, the move to be signing free trade agreements and organizing for international investment is scary to anybody who's organizing cooperative alternatives to big agribusiness. Because while Canadians up till now are not that invested in agricultural activities in Honduras, the primary Canadian investments that people should be keeping their eye on have to do with tourism, and with retirement homes that are being built on traditional Garifuna land on the northern coast of Honduras, as well as gold mining investment. There's already three industrial gold mines owned by Canadian companies in Honduras, and definite look to expand that number. The third other area that Canadians are invested in primarily is in the maquila sector, in the sweatshop labor sector, in terms of producing cheap clothing. But signing free trade agreements is very terrifying for groups like that sort of vision, that kind of idea. It's very terrifying to groups that want to organize cooperatives, because what that does is it invites international investment, which only and only goes to those people that can provide profits. Co-ops aren't built to provide profits. There will be no financing coming to any co-ops as a result of a free trade agreement. It will only go to those agribusinesses that can secure the cheapest labor and the cheapest land, which is often stolen land.
I wonder if you could expand a little bit on the conditions and the kinds of work arrangements that people in Honduras who are forced or once displaced from their lands, are forced to work under in this so-called free trade zones.
You know, in brief, to give you a sense, yeah, people are given bathroom passes, for example. So you only get to go to the bathroom once a day if you're lucky, and you have a ticket, and there's somebody that collects your ticket at the bathroom. If by chance you have to go to the bathroom a second time and you don't have a ticket and you can't convince one of your friends to give you up their daily ticket, you can't go to the bathroom. Women are routinely fired for being pregnant. There's no, much less than maternity leave. You're seen as a potentially slower worker if you're pregnant, and you can lose your job just by being pregnant. Yeah, it does provide this cheap labor force. You can explain the land grabs and explain the move towards agribusiness purely as a need, as a desire to get the land, to get productive land to produce export products like palm oil or like bananas, you know, without necessarily it being part of a scheme to create a pool of cheap labor, but it definitely does have that effect. And, you know, it even has that effect locally, rurally, in order to create a body of cheap labor for the plantations. In the plantations, as soon as, you know, there's adverse weather or, you know, market prices go down for whatever product it is you're producing, people are laid off and rehired, and there's never a shortage of people who are ready to take any job that can be offered. And, you know, part of that reason is that these cooperative options, there's been, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of strategy to deny people any other alternative in terms of, you know, how to provide for their families. And these co-ops that are still existing in the Aguan Valley and elsewhere continue to be kind of a light in the darkness, giving people a real model, not just a theoretical model, but a real model for how to achieve, you know, a more dignified lifestyle. And they've really come under attack since the coup. These co-ops had largely existed, you know, at least in the last 20 years, without too much in the way of intimidation. The expansion of agribusiness and other businesses was working in other directions. But we've seen a few leaders of these co-ops been assassinated since the coup. And it's the first time they've been under that kind of attack in the last 20 years.
Can you talk about the links between this process and the new liberal agenda of privatization and consolidation of resources and wealth?
Yeah, so the Honduran example with education privatization is telling. But one way that's interesting is that one thing that we saw in New Orleans following the hurricane, Katrina, was a mass privatization of education in the form of charter schools. and millions and millions and millions of dollars came in from foundations like the, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and a series of other private foundations that provided the funding to create a series of really high-quality charter schools. And the charter school system in New Orleans has really widespread approval by families in New Orleans as having been a major improvement on pre-Katrina schooling. Now, there's no mystery to this formula. If you fund schools, they'll be better. If you give them more funding, then it just happens that this funding came from private foundations primarily, as opposed to from public funding. They've been defunded since the 60s in terms of public funding. And so these charter schools perform better merely because they have more resources. It's no mystery. So the number one place where Hondurans live in the United States is New Orleans. That's where the major Honduran, for, you know, historical reasons that go back hundreds of years, that's where the major Honduran diaspora live. Particularly rich Hondurans send their kids to study in New Orleans at Tulane University and other places in the area, University of Louisiana. And so Pepe Lobo went to New Orleans to study that model. And, well, Pepe Lobo is the current president of Honduras. And while he was there, he also found out that one of the things that happened through this process was that they were able to essentially destroy the teachers' union in New Orleans through the implementation of the charter school system. And Pepe Lobo's, one of his assistants actually said to the media in New Orleans at that time that this is great because we've got major problems with the teachers' unions in Honduras. And what she meant by that was that the teachers' unions make up, numbers-wise, the biggest percentage of any one group of the national resistance movement. The teachers are by far the most organized at a national level sector of the Honduran working class. They've got about 6 unions that organize every single teacher in the country in the public sector and many in the private sector. And breaking the teachers has been a goal for years and years and years of the Honduran elite, and the coup has really given them their opportunity. And they're doing so through this privatization thing. I think there's, you know, lots of motivations for privatizing education. There's a lot of money to be made out of it as well. And the problem is that you're not going to get the millions and millions of dollars that were pumped into post-Katrina New Orleans in Honduras. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation hasn't, you know, released a press release saying they're ready to pump millions and millions of dollars into this program. It won't have the same effect in Honduras. What will happen is that a lot of families that right now send their kids to public schools will be forced to cut other things in order to send their kids to private schools. And a lot of people will be left without schooling altogether. The defunding of the public education system in Honduras has also been going on for years. It's to the point now where there's many people, many kids that don't have desks at schools in Honduras. Families have organized, you know, the parent-teacher advisory equivalent in Honduras. Its primary function is actually to pool resources of parents so that they can buy desks and books and pens and other things that are necessary for their kids, much less so than, you know, the model that we have here, which is more along the lines of parents getting some sort of input in how the public money is spent. In Honduras, where the parents are poorer, they actually have to pool their resources to supplement the budget for the public education system.
Can you talk about the way in which these policies are not only impacting the social organization of those communities, but also how the land has been impoverished by the kinds of development that is invited? You alluded earlier about the mining projects that have taken place. I wonder if you could expand and talk a little bit about the impact that this has had, not only on food sustainability, the health impacts that this has on the population.
One group that's based in the United States and Canada, a small organization called Rights Action, has really done some of the best work on mining in Honduras. And they recently were able to unearth a story that Goldcorp, which is the second biggest gold mining company in Canada after Barrick, which operates a huge industrial mine in Honduras, under the Zelaya government that was overthrown, Goldcorp was required to invest in some investigations, some studies regarding the public health of the people that lived around their mine. And that was back in 2007. And when they did these studies, they kept the results secret and actually never published them. And Rights Action was able to find out that they knew as early as 2007, they actually had the results in their hands of the extremely high levels of very dangerous substances in the water around their sites. So they found really high levels of arsenic, of cadmium, and a bunch of other heavy metals, lead, that were doing serious damage to the people in the area. And if you go to the area, it's in the Siria Valley in Honduras, not that far from the capital. As many people have started to do now that this has become public knowledge, go to the area and actually look at the population, and you see kids with skin disorders all over the place, many developmental disorders. It's being seen, you know, tragically mostly in kids that have been born since the mine was put into place, and, you know, kids with developmental disorders that make it difficult for them to walk, and a whole bunch of really tragic consequences like this that were what led, even before this study by Goldcorp was known, to the Zelaya government to put in a moratorium on all new gold concessions back in 2008 until such time as they could guarantee that these gold mines were not having adverse public health effects or find a way to work around that. And that didn't stop the mines that were already in action, but it put a stop on opening any new mines. That moratorium, as you can imagine, since the coup has been lifted and the mining sector has been reopened. And we know because of WikiLeaks that the Canadian government was highly involved in that. There was some high-ranking meetings between the local government along with Canadian ambassadors and mining executives that were organized, you know, pretty soon after the coup. At the same time, you know, major investors in Honduras, some of the major families in Honduras, started taking out editorials in the newspapers that they own talking about how gold mining could be a way for Honduras to make it through unscathed through the global economic crisis. Much in the same way that, you know, monoculture agricultural production, primarily palm oil, has been put forward by the corporate media in Honduras as a way to get through the global economic crisis as well, talking about how, you know, another attack on the co-op model, saying that we need to expand the plantations, expand the agribusiness, make them greater scale, greater economies of scale, so that we can produce the kind of export money that is needed to get through this stuff. It's all a big bait and switch for the Honduran population. It's all saying, you know, this will get us through, you know, treating the collective we of the whole country will get through the economic crisis through these investments. But the reality is that in these situations, these people pay no taxes, or according to Honduran law, for example, the mining companies pay 1% taxes, 2% taxes in Honduras, 1% in El Salvador, 2% taxes in Honduras on the incredible record profits that they're making selling gold right now, as we're in an economic recession and gold goes up in value because people see it as one of the only safe investments in a time of economic decline.
There's also being a resistance that has been ongoing. Can you talk about this and perhaps the similarities or the connections that we could draw from that have inspired some of the local movements as we see an Occupy movement also birthing throughout North America?
Yes, I think, you know, most people have been inspired by the Occupy movement in North America. And along with that inspiration has come a lot of attempts by journalists and other commentators to try and talk about, you know, where were the roots of that movement? You know, where did it start? Did it start in Tunisia? Did it start in Egypt? Did it start in Spain? Did it start at Wall Street? It's kind of a crazy game to play. I mean, if we're talking about occupations and effective occupations, the Honduran farmers have been occupying productive palm land, taking millions of dollars away from extremely powerful agricultural corporations that have a military on their side and paying with their lives. If we're going to talk about occupations, I don't mean to put, this is not in any way taking anything away from occupying public parks and public space. As we've seen, that's been an extremely powerful tactic in North America. But, I mean, they've been doing this for over a decade now in Honduras, particularly since 2009. You know, taking over highly productive land and, you know, 10,000 hectares. So if we're going to talk about the roots of occupying as a tactic, I mean, we could go back longer than that. But I think that the Honduras example has been one that's been really ignored by people who've been trying to trace the roots of this. And, you know, it's the Honduran resistance was part of a summer in 2009 when the Iranian resistance also rose up. And I think a lot of people were inspired by the Iranian resistance in 2009, the Green Movement. But the truth is that there wasn't a lot of clear information coming out of Iran about that. And people were sort of left with just sort of a general feeling that people were rising up in Iran. Whereas in Honduras, there was a ton of information coming out, primarily in Spanish, but a ton of information about how they were organizing, about the resistance movement itself. And the result of that today is that there's now a structure in Honduras for a whole new kind of politics that's been built in, you know, just over 2 years. And so now you have a situation in Honduras where every one of the 300 municipalities in the small country has a resistance coordination at the local level, where people come in and are encouraged to participate by telling their stories, sharing their experiences, and then talking about potential solutions. And out of this has come, one arm of it is a political party, which will participate in the 2013 elections, but also has been just a series of community organizations that have come up and started talking about many other things. For example, building a community radio station. So we've seen a lot of community radio stations that have come up as a result of people coming together and saying, I'm finding out for the first time all these things about my country that I didn't know about before because I've been reading the corporate media or listening to the corporate media. We need our own, you know, radio station. We need to join this community radio movement. And so, you know, this is one tangible example that's come out of having communities starting to get organized and starting to come together. We've seen solidarity across sectors in a way that, you know, people talk about as having never existed in Honduras before, where you have students coming out to join, you know, campesino or farmer occupations. You've got the farmers coming out to join the teachers when they go on strike and blockade a highway. So there's a kind of solidarity that's being built as well. And it's well documented in primarily in Spanish, as I said. And it's really inspiring to see.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us. You've been covering Honduras for years now. And how can people access your report and learn more about this struggle?
Yeah, so the best way is on the internet, primarily. All my reports, or the majority of my reports, have been for the Real News Network, which is at www.therealnews.com. I'm currently working on a couple documentaries outside of the Real News, one about the occupation movement in the Aguan Valley, and one about the Garifuna movement on the North Coast, primarily against Canadian tourism and retirement home investors. And so retirement community. And so those will be coming out soon, and hopefully I can come back on your show once they come out to talk about it and to talk about the reaction to it.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to hearing from you on that report.
Yeah, always a pleasure. And thank you so much for keeping your eye on Honduras, because you're one of the few people who's doing it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.